Yeah, let's go 286 first. Good afternoon. Welcome to House Judiciary. In attendance are Representative Holmes, Representative Samuels, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramirez, Representative Coghill. Excused absences and prayers go out to our two friends, Representative Gruenberg and Representative Lynn. We have two matters before us today. The first is House Bill 286, and then we will take up House Bill 281. We will hear testimony and then hold it over address it sometime next week, hopefully. So with that, Representative Dahlstrom, who is going to present House Bill 286, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go ahead and give a few comments, and then I'd like to ask Jenny from my office if she'd come up to the table, and then she's prepared to help me answer questions if that's acceptable.
Sure. Anybody want a cookie?
All right, Jenny, come on up for you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you is House Bill 286, and it's an act impersonating a public servant. And I'm not going to say a simple bill because I've made it through 6 years without saying that, and that's my goal. But it is very straightforward. Very straightforward. Current law says that unlawfully impersonating a peace officer is a misdemeanor, and the bill before the committee today will increase the penalty to a Class C felony. Mr. Chairman, you know that unfortunately in our society there are those that use deception as part of a criminal act, and one way that they do this is to lure unsuspecting victims by pretending to be someone that they're not. And this criminal behavior, the desire to intentionally mislead another, should, I believe, and the others who have signed on this bill with me, is, and you are one of them, should have a stronger punishment. There is a growing concern for safety in our communities all over the state, and what this bill does is it adds teeth to the existing law, provides another tool for law enforcement agencies. An added bonus for me personally would be that it serves as a deterrent for those who deliberately make choices that put our families, our friends, our loved ones in situations of risk. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions about the intent of this, and also have staff here who's been working with me on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Hi, Jenny. Do you have anything that you want to add or?
Well, for the record, my name is Jenny Baxter, and I'm staff to Representative Nancy Dahlstrom. No, she really covered everything. As you can see, what we added was another classification to existing law. So. What we did change is made impersonating a public servant in the first degree a Class C felony. And what that is pretending to be a peace officer. So.
Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, to either one that can answer, what is the penalty now for doing this?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, it is a Class B misdemeanor.
And is that something that can accumulate if you do four or five different times? We've talked about that in other venues, and I just, because it's fresh in my mind, I'm asking.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, usually misdemeanors don't have any jail time unless there is a significant criminal history.
Okay. And then another one, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
How did you arrive at a penalty of C felony?
Well, I guess when we were working with the legal services across the street, that that would be our next step in from what it was, just one more.
A couple questions I'm going to have as we go into this, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Once we get into the felony world, life changes for everybody. And here we're going to have, no doubt, I've read the backup. People can use that position of authority to gain access to people in ways that puts our guard down. So I appreciate that. But what we're doing is we're getting now, we're going to make it a felony to act like somebody, even if there was no wrong action beyond that. And so I get nervous about that, and so to me, I'm going to be looking for the high bar. How do we get there? And so if I miss something in backup, as to why that should be a felony, I'm going to be hard to get.
Mr. Chairman, can I add something to that?
Yes.
Thank you. There are people here with the troopers, and I believe the Juneau Police Department, and maybe even some folks online that are willing to testify, and appreciate them taking the time. But most of the situations, and I think the officers can address this with more accuracy, because I don't know what facts about the cases I can and cannot say on record, but it allows them in a situation where this harm and this intent to deceive people is happening to take the person immediately for incarceration if it's necessary, or the vehicle they're driving can be impounded, the equipment that they're using for this could be taken, and gets them off the street right then.
And I understood that, but I can also see that there are other sides that it could be used, Mr. Chairman. So I'll listen to the testimony,
right.
And but that's the hurdle I'm going to have to get over. Yep. Why should we have a felony for something that is prospectively a problem, but may not be immediately a problem? So I just struggle with that.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure that this is so much a question for the sponsors, but it's one that I'd like to get on the record before we have other people testify so they can address it, is that kind of following in the same vein as Representative Coghill, the question is, what does somebody have to do or not do to be convicted of this? And the language is, they pretend to be a public servant, and does any act in that capacity? And I'll just be looking for a little bit more fleshing out what that means, as Representative Coghill was saying. What is that burden? What do they have to do or not do? Clearly, we're not trying to get people to dress up like a police officer on Halloween. but clearly, we are trying to keep people from that. So where? What is the hurdle right here? What are we looking at?
Well, speaking on behalf of myself as a victim annually, I'd like to see the hurl rate include the legislative skits. I think that those people should be subjected to see felony depending on the... but it does raise precisely the issue. Representative Johnson, we are delighted to see you. We are working on House Bill 286. You're welcome to join us here at the table.
I'm quite fine, thank you.
Okay. And we're probably going to spend a half of an hour on this, I think. So we'd be delighted to have your company. But if you want to be productive in return, we're also making mindful of that. That does pose an interesting question. But fraud is all around us. You know, I heard there was already a rash of it here in the state as regarding the federal rebate program and the energy rebate program that was opposed by Representative Thomas. So fraud in various forms, whether it's a uniform public servant or because I assume that somebody who would be calling under the guise of Representative Thomas's bill on the $1,000 energy rebate would assume the demeanor of a public servant over the telephone, and I think Mr. Sabodny would be able to tell us what spate of laws are broken by doing that. But this, I gather, would be another one. It'd be one thing if you just said you were a banker. It would be another thing if you said you were with the state of Alaska. I assume that we would then be somewhere inside of this statute. You had to make a comment, Jenny?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to add some clarification and possibly answer Representative Holmes's question, because it has been a reoccurring question with this bill. And I did speak to legal services about, well, what about people who dress up in Halloween costumes as officers of the law? And the reason it does not apply to them is because they are not acting in that capacity. And then I think with Representative Coghill's concern, how come we're creating a Class C felony for people who aren't causing harm, I believe. Obviously, this bill, we wanted it to target those who intend to cause harm, and more specifically, those who are impersonating police officers, state troopers. I believe there's the definition of peace officer in statute. which does say to maintain public order and to make arrests. But we will have some examples, I believe, with the state trooper sitting behind us, of people who are impersonating these peace officers that do not necessarily cause harm, but why it is a problem. And hopefully that this bill would be a deterrent to those people if it were now a felony.
Give it away.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. Questions? Otherwise, Trooper Cox, are you here to testify?
Yes.
Do you want to join us? Do you want to join us? You can stay, Danny. Feel state. We appreciate you being really helpful. Nice to see you, sir. Thanks for finding time to. You didn't sign in, but we recognize you with your stern look.
Actually, I did sign in.
Oh, you did.
Somewhere. And Mr. Chair, I just want to state that he was supposed to go home yesterday to his family, but his feelings on the need for this bill he extended for us. So I'm appreciative of that.
We are all. We thank you for your service to the state of Alaska and standing in harm's way to protect our citizens and our communities. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, we really appreciate it.
My name is Rob Cox. I'm here basically twofold. I'm the president of Public Safety Employees Association, which represents the working troops and police officers all over Alaska, and also currently employed and working as an Alaska State Trooper.
Thank you. Do you have testimony to offer, or would you prefer to just answer questions?
I have testimony to offer, and then certainly, hopefully this will clear up
sure.
questions, but, you know.
Please proceed.
Firstly, our association certainly thanks Representative Dahlstrom for her demonstrated support for Alaskans and for the law enforcement officers of Alaska by introducing House Bill 286. Each of us here has likely heard or either read of accounts of people impersonating police officers. In each instance, I'm sure our citizens experience some feeling of shock and anguish as they've learned of these incidents regardless of the outcome. During my 17-plus years experience as an Alaska State Trooper in the Mat-Su Valley, I've investigated or personally known of two such perpetrators. There have also been similar cases outside the Mat-Su area, and currently the penalty for impersonating a police officer, as stated earlier, is a B misdemeanor, which is slightly more serious than a traffic violation and is seldom prosecuted. Fortunately, none of the Alaska cases that I'm aware of have yet resulted in injury, death, sexual assault, or other serious crime. But they've caused victims extreme fear, and I know this because I've spoken directly to some of those victims. The Alaska cases seem to have been motivated by ego, experimentation, or some twisted sense of fun. And because our officers were swift to identify and apprehend the perpetrators, we fortunately didn't have any ugly outcomes. However, some other states and cities around the nation have not been so fortunate, resulting in investigating murder, assault, and rape. The most recent perpetrator in the Mat-Su Valley was apprehended just a few weeks ago. Both the Alaska State Troopers and the Anchorage Police had been searching for him for some time, and reportedly he had once previously been charged with impersonating a peace officer or public servant. And the records seem to indicate that he was never prosecuted or convicted on the charge. Interestingly, even though he had flashed his red and blue lights that were in his car at citizens, when he was contacted, the trooper was unable to arrest him because a misdemeanor not committed in the presence of the officer is not an arrestable offense. As ironic as they may sound, the trooper was very grateful that this guy was driving drunk, because it made him arrestable, made his car impoundable and his police equipment impoundable, and it took him off the street before he could do anything really ugly. House Bill 286 is good for Alaska and for law enforcement by increasing the penalty of impersonating a public servant to a felony level when it's a peace officer that they impersonate. It enables officers to arrest and stop the offender based upon probable cause and strongly discourages this activity by would-be pranksters or egomaniacs. House Bill 286 demonstrates real commitment to the safety of Alaskans and our law enforcement officers and enhances mutual trust. PSEA and the working line officers around the state strongly encourage the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Trooper Cox. Representative Samus?
Thank you, Trooper Cox, very much for being here. You said the equipment, just in that example you gave. I mean, was this a full-blown fake police car? I mean, baton, firearm?
The equipment that was seized, you're talking about the example that I gave of just a few weeks ago?
Or what do you anticipate being the problem? Does somebody dress up as an officer and come to a door?
I haven't known of anybody dressing up as an officer. The uniform, an exact uniform is very difficult to come by. But as any of you know that have been contacted by officers, there's a number of officers around the state who are either off duty or working a plainclothes detail and make traffic stops and contact the public in that. In fact, this perpetrator that I gave you just a few weeks ago actually told a Wasilla Police Department officer who had contacted him that he was an off-duty state trooper. The car that he had was looked like an unmarked police car because it was, a Crown Vic, a Ford Crown Vic. Anybody can purchase the emergency lights, the radio equipment. I mean, there's not restricted access to that equipment, and he had done so. Interestingly, the arrest for DUI and the fact that all of this information became so widely known to law enforcement, and his actions were discouraged to the point to where he put his equipment up on eBay for sale. And we got then to see the pictures of the equipment that he had. And he had a full-blown radio system, lights like you see not on the outside, but on the inside of the car. It would have been very, very difficult, if not impossible, to differentiate him from a real officer from that.
Okay, and then I guess a question for the sponsor, for Ms. Baxter. What about on the telephone? I mean, if you call up somebody and say this is a police officer, and generally speaking, I agree with the bill. I'll tell you that right now. I get it. Mm-hmm. But what about situations where you'd have somebody that calls up and says, I remember in my previous life, people would call and want donations for the Fraternal Order of Alaska State Troopers. And I don't know exactly what they did, but I can tell you we probably donated tickets. Do you picture the impersonation on the telephone also being a Class C felony?
Interesting distinction.
And if you think so, I'm not saying it's pro or con, but what would be, I guess, for Trooper Cox, what would be the pros and cons of saying a Class C felony for leaving a message on somebody's machine in the middle of a divorce, child custody battle type thing?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, pros and cons of it being a C felony, I don't know that there's any real cons to that. When even over the phone, I identify myself as an Alaska State Trooper or police officer to somebody, there is an automatic sense of trust and what's that?
Or fear.
Well, concern sometimes, depending. I mean, they don't know what I'm calling for, but.
Glass half full. Glass half empty.
But because of that automatic trust, when they believe that there's a police officer contacting them, people are much more open to giving personal information. If I were to call somebody from my home and just identify myself as Mr. Cox and say, hey, what's your driver's license number, what's your birth date, what's your home address, your telephone number, people get real suspicious. But if they truly believe that I am a police officer, I don't have any problem getting that information from them.
You would from me.
We're not going there with you, Coghill. Excuse me, Mr.
No,
Chair.
It's all right. So if I understand the distinction correctly, impersonating a public servant is still a Class B misdemeanor. Impersonating a peace officer exclusively would be elevated to a Class C felony. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Impersonating a public servant in the first degree is impersonating a peace officer.
Okay. So the question I'm going to have for Mr. Svobodny, and we have Jeff, how do I say your last name? Is it Land Daughter? Is Jeff here?
He intended to be here. He's
So the question that I would have is that I think we'll ask Mr. Svobodny, because if a person is impersonating a peace officer or a public servant to access private information, I'm certain that we're violating some statute that's on the books, but I wouldn't perceive that I would be at immediate risk of injury. Whereas if I were stopped and somebody flashed a badge or pulled me over on a road system with, you know, phony emergency lights impersonating an officer, I would feel a heightened sense of risk. So I wonder that we want to draw a line between somebody impersonating a peace officer over the telephone and you know, is a nuisance selling tickets who may not be the fraternal, of troopers versus somebody that, you know, physically stops a vehicle. And so that's a question I'll probably have for Mr. Svobodny. Do you appreciate that distinction, Trooper? I mean, no doubt that it's inappropriate for somebody to impersonate an officer over the phone to access information, but I don't feel any immediate risk, whereas if somebody knocked on my door and said, "I'm a state trooper, let me come into your home," and I discovered that they weren't, there would be a more severe threat of bodily harm, I think.
Mr. Chair, I would just add that if I was a single woman or a married woman and home by myself, or, you know, whatever the situation was, and someone called and said that they were a police officer, or even just a prank call, that's very frightening. And if they tell me they're a police officer and they start asking specific questions and information and then say, "Well, you're not cooperating and you're therefore blah, 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 you know, this is going to happen," or whatever, for me personally, that would be very disturbing. And if I were to be a mom at work and have one of my children call me from home and say that that had just happened, I mean, I would be dialing the police station as I was in my car immediately going to my home. It would be extremely serious.
I agree, Representative Dahlstrom, but isn't there a difference between somebody calling on the phone and frightening you and somebody knocking on your door and flashing a badge and telling your children, "I'm an Alaska State Trooper," when in fact they're not? We'll have a committee discussion here shortly. How do you feel about that, Trooper Cox?
I appreciate that question and that concern, and I think that there's an automatic assumption that because you're talking on a telephone line and don't have face-to-face contact, that the degree of danger is much different or greatly diminished. I think with the proliferation of cell phones and how easy a cell phone is to get, just because you're on a telephone doesn't necessarily diminish the danger and the threat. I mean, that person could very well be, I've done this in the exercise of my duties in looking for people who have arrest warrants, being right in their driveway and calling the house.
Okay.
And that, you know, very easy to do.
Okay. I want to recognize that our friend Representative Gatto is here, and nice to see you, Representative Gatto. I assume you're comfortable where you are doing what you're doing. You're welcome to join us if you'd like. Mr. Svobodny, can you come up and join us and talk about the bill in general, and then maybe touch on this specific point, the distinction between a public servant and a peace officer, and the difference between impersonating a peace officer in person as opposed to doing it electronically? Because the electronically would also include the Internet. Trooper Cox, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it a great deal. Other questions for Mr. Svobodny? Representative Cocker?
Maybe the first thing we can do is talk about Class C felony and how that would fall into the crimes against people and not, and just how Department of Law might see this coming in. Would it be pled out immediately? Is it set up high so that it could have that effect? Or does it fall into other C felonies as this is what we got to go for? Because you heard my question right off the bat is, this is prospective problem, possibly. And I'm going to ask other questions, like public servant has a much broader approach than just a police officer. And I'm thinking about my OCS workers and those who have to go collect UI taxes and stuff like that.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and through the chair, Representative Coghill. I'm not sure that I understand your question. I'm not really sure where to go with it. I would say to you that, in general, there are not provisions of law that where the conduct jumps up in seriousness, that they jump from a B misdemeanor to a C felony. I don't know of another provision that would do that. That's not to say that to make it a C felony is inappropriate. I mean, that's a public policy question about how serious the offense is. I take a little exception to what Trooper Cox said in that because things are B misdemeanors mean that they don't get prosecuted. They may not get submitted to the district attorney's office because people perceive them as not as serious offenses, but I would like to hear about DA's offices who aren't prosecuting cases simply because of the classification that the legislature has decided they should be. The difference between a C felony and a B misdemeanor is the maximum penalty for a B misdemeanor is 90 days in jail. The maximum penalty for a C felony is 5 years in jail. That's not to say that that's what the person would get. That's just telling you what the maximums are.
Just on that point, Mr. Chairman. Yes, then, if I understand correctly, C felony also, you begin to lose certain liberties that go along with that. And from C to an A, there's probably some variation. But can you give me a concept on that? Because I remember discussing it one time before, but I can't remember.
The two that I can think of off the top of my head, and I want to qualify the second one. It is clearly the case if you're convicted of a C felony, you lose the right to carry a concealable firearm. People who have been convicted of any felony offense don't have the right to carry a concealable firearm for a period of time. There's some exceptions to that. There used to be restrictions on voting rights and jury service. There's no statutory restriction, I don't believe, any longer on jury service. There's a court rule that allows the state to challenge somebody for cause if they've had a conviction in the last 2 years. And then last year, I know that there was a bill in, and frankly, I didn't follow it that closely, so I don't know whether it became law or not, that there were restrictions on voting rights. And there was a bill last year to eliminate any restrictions on voting rights. Those are the three that come to mind. I will tell you that there are, outside of legal impediments, there are other impediments that society imposes, like it may be substantially more difficult to get bonding if you have a felony offense. Employers might not hire you, but those are outside the context of a legislative prohibition.
Including, Mr. Chairman, if we have anybody that works with vulnerable people, whether it's children or older people. And so that's why, to me, the hurdle starts ratcheting up, because what we do is we bar them from a lot of employment opportunities and a lot of places where, you know. And so if it's a good reason, I don't mind saying, if you're going to have a concealed weapon and you've been convicted of this, you got a problem. to me, I want to make sure that we're actually getting that right, that we're actually having somebody that is that much of a danger to society that this is warranted. And so I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it.
Mr. Sabodny, can you address my concern, which is any kind of an electronic impersonation of a peace officer or a public servant? What other statutes does a person violate in doing that? The example that Trooper Cox used was identifying yourself as a state trooper on the telephone and requesting a great deal of personal information. Can you talk about that, please?
What other crimes might be occurring as a result of using some electronic communication device?
I think so. I think in representing yourself as a public servant.
Oh, as representing.
Or a peace officer and trying to access personal information.
There's no distinction under the present law whether or not the impersonation is in person or remotely by using any type of device. And so right now, I mean, it's a misdemeanor offense to pretend to be a police officer, whether you're doing it in person or over the telephone. So the statutes don't make any distinction as to whether it's an in-person or a remote access. I mean, our imaginations are fertile, and sometimes you can think of circumstances where a person would be substantially more afraid of something happening over the telephone. I think there was even a movie about that, versus in person. So, I mean, we haven't yet drawn the distinction between using the telephone versus in person.
Let me draw it in and seek the advice of some of the members of the committee. Methamphetamine. We handled that piece of legislation. It was important to me some years ago, and I think it was in the Judiciary Committee, Representative Coghill, and I was there and not here at the time. And the issue came up, I have a remote lodge, and so I'm buying a lot of single-ingredient cold medicine for my lodge, or I think Senator Seekins talked about his wife, Connie, collecting cold medicine in a shoebox because she collected a lot of cold medicine, and she crossed over from being a citizen to being a felon in the strictest interpretation, and then testimony was offered. Well, nobody would do that, but the rebuttal was, but nevertheless, you have committed a C felony by doing it. So, if I called my friend Ralph Samuels at Penn Air and left him a message, you know, in my private sector life, and I said, "Hey, yeah, tell him that Trooper Johnson called, blah blah blah, and you left, you know, your athletic gear." I mean, I probably would lace it with profanities and things, but if I, so he would know that I was kidding, or it would be some far-fetched thing meant to embarrass him in front of his coworkers. But in essence, I would have unintentionally crossed a line that actually would be subject to a C felony, even though I was just kidding. But the electronic use of that would be like Mrs. Seekins having a shoebox full of cold medicine. That's not what she's doing. She certainly isn't a threat to society, but the strict definition of the law, she's a felon. And we had a hard time, I think, kind of making it over that hurdle and learning how to address that. And so if there's no malice, obviously, if I'm calling Representative Samuels and fooling around, but what's the difference?
Mr. Chairman, first I want to defend Ms. Seekins. I don't know if I want to defend you.
I deserve that, Mr.
Zavalotny. She for the methamphetamine offense, you have to intend to possess those things with the intent to make methamphetamine. So she's safe, okay? You, on the other hand,
yeah.
The culpable mental state is that you have to knowingly pretend to be a police officer in your example, and you have to knowingly engage in an act. Now, here, I think your act is the verbal communication. So, I mean, I think you're accurate that somebody technically has violated the law. That's why, kind of under the American system of justice, the prosecutors have discretion to say it's not really a crime. I mean, there was no intent to harm somebody. I point out there isn't an intent to harm in the present statute. So that's why, I mean, why you, under those circumstances, would be committing a crime. And there may be a very good reason why in 1970, well, I'm not going to say, I'm going to put it, change my mind. In 1978, when the legislature passed this statute, there was a very good reason for not requiring intent there. I mean, it scares people. If my wife received a phone call from somebody and said, I work for the city and borough of Juneau, and I need to know some things about your electrical consumption. Could you tell me, do you have a meter inside or outside your house? Whether they were playing around or not, that would scare her. Ultimately, she found out that that was somebody who wasn't the public servant they were pretending to be. So there is a good reason not for the B misdemeanor not to include the intent to commit harm.
Yes, I agree with that, but I wonder, does that rise to the standard of being a C felony when I think of other offenses? Representative Bilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Svobodny, I apologize. Mr. Rick.
Thank you.
The instance that Chair Ramirez gave on the electronic and calling his good friend, Representative Samuels, I mean, you know, I can totally see that scenario playing out, the two of them going back and forth. However, it would never come to anyone's attention unless one of them picked up the phone and placed a call or drove down somewhere and filed a complaint. So you would not be involved. Now, if I am on the other hand, I don't know who this person is that's calling me and saying these things. And I make the assumption that if somebody has my phone number, that they have my address, and that they probably have a picture of what I look like, and they might even know my schedule because they might have been watching, and they know what time I go to church on Sunday, and they know what time I leave for my various activities during the week, and I start thinking about all the potentials that could happen, and so I'm going to make a phone call. But when I know it's my good friend Jay pranking me, I'm not going to call you because I know you're busy with or the troopers are busy with very serious, real things. And I know that's a joke. I mean, to me, that's part of the distinction of what's being discussed here. These calls are going to go on, but you're not going to be, the troopers and public safety is not going to be involved unless Samuels decides he's really torqued at him and calls.
Yeah, and then the joke's on me.
Am I correct in?
Through the chair, absolutely. I mean, society operates that way on a day-in, day-out basis. I mean, it is a crime. It's an assault to punch another person. But no one reports that their four-year-old, you know, hit their five-year-old today. I mean, we know that that's not something that's going to be dealt with in the criminal law, or in the example that you gave where people are joking around on the phone. I mean, society, I venture to say that we get Trooper Cox up here, he's never going to have got a complaint like that unless that phone call itself was intending to harass somebody.
So Mr. Spudney, do you have a question?
I have a couple going around in my head.
So Mr. Spudney, the question that I have is not to take issue with elevating a person impersonating a peace officer at my door or on the road system or when I'm conducting commerce, but how do you feel, what's your professional opinion about it happening electronically over the phone, on the internet, using a cell phone? Does it rise to the same standard? Is it, or is that better? Left as a B misdemeanor. I recognize that's a policy call that we're asked to make, but I'd like to get your opinion on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, criminals have such fertile minds. I can conceive of situations where making the phone call is a more frightening thing than coming to your home in person. I can conceive of that. As a general rule, however, we the more physical distance there is between people, the less fearful they are. If I can go back to give to my assault example, mm-hmm. I mean, we talked the other day about fear assaults. And if I call somebody up and say, you know, I'm coming over to beat you up, they aren't as fearful as if I'm standing there waving my fist. And as a matter of fact, that I'm coming over to beat you up sometime in the future is probably not an assault, because our elements of assault require fear of imminent physical injury. So I mean, we recognize that the distance between human beings lessens the fear, I think, as a general rule. If I may just give a commercial for the example that was, or a public service announcement. When, as Representative Dahlstrom said, when somebody calls her up, she assumes that they have her address. If they don't, all they have to do is go to Google and put in that phone number, and they do have your address. That's a very frightening thing to a lot of people in this country, because if you have the phone number and you have access to the internet, you have the address.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got two things going on in my head. First one's following up very much on what we've just been talking about, and going around in my head is the thought that while there isn't really a mental state requirement for the Class B misdemeanor that's in the current statute, maybe there needs to be some sort of slightly higher barrier, to bump it up to a C felony. Do you have any thoughts on that?
If I may, through the chair, Representative Holmes, personally, what my feeling would be, I think that we ought to have three levels of this offense. We ought to have what we have now. We ought to have an A misdemeanor when there's intent to do harm, and we ought to have a C felony when it's a police officer and there's an intent to do harm. I mean, that to me, I mean, I think it's got to be a very scary thing if somebody comes to your door, knocks on the door, and wants to get access to your house under the ruse of being a building inspector. And that may well be more frightening than somebody calling on the phone and saying they're from the Benevolent Order of Police and please contribute $100. I mean, they're both really intending to do harm. They're both intending to do harm, but it seems to me there ought to be maybe a gradation of what happens here.
Okay. Thank you. That was very helpful. Mr. Chairman, if I may go on to the second question. Going back to the question I asked at the beginning, the language in the existing statute, which requires the person to pretend to be a public servant and does any act in that capacity, still trying to get to that discussion we were having earlier of what kind of act does one have to, what does it mean to take it to act in that capacity?
Through the chair, we can tell who the lawyers are on the committee. That was the question that went through my mind.
Would you say that again, please? I was having a hard time focusing.
Mr. Chairman, this it's on page 1, lines 10 and 11. It's and this is language that's in the existing statute already. It says that to commit the crime of impersonating a public servant in the second degree, if the person pretends to be a public servant and does any act in that capacity, what does it mean to do an act in that capacity? That was the question.
I looked, actually, when I was sitting back there for the definition of act, and I don't see it immediately. I mean, it is not in where we have our definitional sections. So then you would use the dictionary definition of what an act would be. For terroristic threatening, for example, acts requires repeated acts, and the appellate courts have indicated that a communication is an act. So I would say to you that without doing a lot of legal research, to communicate a certain piece of information would be an act. I mean, there's an exception to the hearsay rule, verbal acts.
Okay. If I may, why isn't the person dressing up as a police officer on Halloween, why wouldn't they fall under this statute, or would they?
Well, they have to do an act, and I interpret it to be in the capacity of being a police officer. They'd have to be trying to put you under arrest, putting handcuffs on somebody, making them fill out a citation, something like that.
Wouldn't,
Or couldn't they be at the party?
Well, I'm thinking.
And they go to the liquor store?
Sorry?
Couldn't they be at the party, not committing a crime, but go to the liquor store an hour later and pretend to be a police officer and then in fact cross that line?
If that was a question to me, yes, I think they could.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been brought up a couple times about what's the meaning of, you know, act, and what does someone have to do to impersonate a peace officer? And I'm going to use an example that I think is all near and dear and everyone at this table's experience. Representative Coghill serves as a rules chair. There's certain things that happen in the conduct of our legislative business, whether it's here in committee or on the floor or whatever, and he might give us a look. And we know, and we know the answer to what it was we were contemplating doing or saying or whatever. There's other times I personally have looked across the floor at him to see I got the answer I needed from the look. Just as when a parent is in the home, things run different than when the parent tells a kid do A, B, C, D, and they're not, or the, you know, it's that way. It doesn't always have to be an act. It's the presence of, and when you have someone that in our society, we have elevated out of necessity to this position that they can have authority over others because those others are doing things that can harm folks. Just their presence in uniform, showing the badge, pulling up in the car, flashing the lights behind you, that's an act, even if they don't say a word with their mouth.
Representative Coghill?
Thank you for noticing the looks.
Only protocol.
I probably won't live that one down either. I tend to agree with Mr. Slovotny. I'm thinking of how many public servants we have in the government that are expected to have certain authority. I use the OCS one because they do have a police authority of sorts. So there have been times where I think people have misused that as individuals posing to be trying to get information and got caught in the process, and fortunately it didn't result in any harm, but I've heard of that. I think even down to the buildings inspector. So I tend to agree with him on changing this, because I think the fear level of having a set of lights flashing and you stop and pull over, at that point, you may not know what kind of fear or situation you may very well be in. So you could be in danger of your life without even knowing it. You know, so I mean, I think those levels, and that's why I was asking, public servant, C felony, impersonating, a whole range of issues came up. But the one incident that you're talking about, I tend to agree with, but that is on the one end of the scale. The other end of the scale could be probably the party prank. But I lived through teenage years where I probably did some things I shouldn't have. I never did impersonate an officer, but I think that we did pull some pranks that were scary without realizing the gravity of what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'd want to be saddling some of those guys with C felonies the rest of their life necessarily. So, I mean, there is a range, isn't there, where people really are bad actors and they intend to do bad things to people by using that kind of position of trust that we of society generally have relied on. So so to the sponsor, I'm only asking those questions because I don't mind making those bad actors felons.
Right.
Because to me it rises to that level. But the general statement here is that it's all public servants, and man, that can get broad. And so, and with each level of servant, you could have a range of questions, just like we've asked here. to what degree, to what level. So anyway, I tend to, I like the suggestion that came out of Mr. Slotny.
And for clarification, Mr. Chair, what, if I understand this correctly, Representative Coghill, what you, I'm agreeing with what you're saying. However, my interpretation is that the part that's impersonating a public servant, which, I mean, for example, some poor sap wants to impersonate me in this job, right? You know, I mean, that is obviously at a way different level than impersonating a peace officer, but that is already covered in statute. That's already there. So, I mean, I don't believe that your intent is that we go back and change what's already there in statute. My intent is to add more to it and tighten it up. I'm open to discussion on even the tightening up part. Maybe we have an A, B, and a C. But the other part in public, we're not changing anything with impersonating a public servant. That's there already right now.
I understand that. But I think Mr. Slotny, Mr. Chairman, said that the practical matter of how we would then apply it with a higher penalty becomes probably a different style of use. And I think certainly that's what you intend to do. However, knowing the litigious nature of our society, one could use it against another, I think, inappropriately, or one could inadvertently get caught in a C felony situation that really didn't rise to that level. Now, that you would have to get convicted, so I guess there's that safeguard. I understand
right.
that. But we just have to contemplate. You're talking about police officers. And I see a whole range of people that we in this legislature have given certain levels of authority to do things that may not raise to this level. I'm just trying to think of what they might be. I remember we had a discussion on the floor not too long ago about whether we should have child support enforcement agencies carrying handguns and what that would do. And I came to the same conclusion. On one hand, I think we want to keep our trust level up to people who are those public servants. On the other side of this argument, I'm here saying, I wonder if the felony fits this circumstance.
Well, Mr. Chair, I asked for a request. I'm wondering if it'd be possible to have Trooper Cox come back, since we've referenced back to his testimony so many times, come to the table and maybe add a few comments. And then could I ask for the liberty of maybe leaving the table for a bit and doing some rewriting, calling Ledge Legal, and see what we can do?
Okay. Yeah, just a little bit of housekeeping. Do we have anybody else here who wants to offer a public testimony on House Bill 286? Is anybody else online in the room? Okay. So, Mr. Spodney, before we ask Trooper Cox to come back, I was caught unpleasantly. I like the additional tier that you inserted. Could you go over that again for the benefit of the members? You suggested that there could be a Class A misdemeanor.
Let me start by the lowest one, which is Class B misdemeanor, which is the present law.
Okay.
The Class A misdemeanor, which would be 0 to a year in jail, is if you were if you impersonated a public service with the intent to do harm. I mean, I could come up with some other things if you intended to get into somebody's house. I mean, I could see that as a scary circumstance, too. You're asking me to do this on the fly here. But, I mean, it seems to me that there is a gradient of people, of things that you can do that are more serious than this B misdemeanor offense, impersonating a public servant. And then the third tier, the aggravated offense, would be if you intended to do harm, and you were impersonating a police officer. And, you know, it doesn't take much. I don't know how many of you have seen the Academy Award nominated movie No Country for Old Men. Oh, yeah. I mean, a person in a patrol car, they get another car, just turned on the sirens to stop somebody and kill them. And that's kind of, you know, that's not, I don't want to say that's common in our society, but it is not uncommon for people to impersonate police officers to gain some type of advantage, whether it's somebody's car or for other reasons.
If I may just weigh in on that, if we are going to take an Addie's side, I'd be a lot more comfortable kind of heading this way, just adding, when we're talking about felonies, talking about some sort of actual intent to, I understand the fear element, but, you know, you want to make sure the person's actually a bad actor and not a practical joke if we're talking felonies, in my view.
Representative Samuels, and then I also have a question.
Thank you, but the person that was described by Trooper Cox was a guy who had gotten a burgundy Grand Vic with lights and a siren and a tie on, or even not a tie on, and he's going to have to go find a lawyer, and you're going to have to prove that he had intent to do harm. Well, you know, that's the guy. I mean, I'm willing to probably go with the bill. If you want to add the second class for the building inspector, that's fine, but what else would he be doing pulling over somebody? You drive by, you see the single woman in a car, you get behind her, you pull her over. Why else would you do it? Why else would, I can't think of another reason you would fake to be a cop in a cop car, which is all practical purposes is a cop car. You know, and I have specific examples of jokes that I've played on my friends where I was a Montana State police officer when she was in college in Montana and asked what was in her baggage coming home, and I knew what it was there and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's a way different story than, and nobody's ever going to take me to court for that or anything. You know, you got to give some latitude for common sense. But the guy, the example, you got me with the example, the guy with the Grand Vic and the lights. Now you have to go prove intent to do harm. I guess I don't buy it. Why else would you do that? Why else would you turn a siren and lights on to pull over a complete stranger?
Okay. Mr. Spodney, my question is, does the language that you're recommending to us, does that address Representative Coghill's concern that it's a broader net of bad characters that would than just peace officers who could, are there other categories of public servants that would create the intention of doing a threat or harm?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that the definition of public servant is very broad, and just like it's been referred here today, that it includes all of you. If you're asking, are there other people that we should include? I guess I think the answer to that is no, because you're going to either you can't defend against this by saying, well, that position doesn't even exist. That's not a defense to impersonating a public servant. So I don't think that the definition of public I feel comfortable that Representative Coghill came up with somebody he thought was a public servant. I think it would fit under the definition.
Okay. All right. Trooper Cox, could you rejoin us? Just a couple of questions. And the bill sponsor has indicated that she likes the bill in its current form. And Mr. Rules Chairman, as Trooper Cox comes up, refresh me. It requires four yea votes if there's a in order to move a bill from committee with two excused members?
Yes, and you won't have any trouble with me moving the bill, but I just think these are the kind of questions we have to answer, because the example given is not the only example that can happen.
Yes, it's a universe of examples. Oh, Trooper. Questions for Trooper Cox?
Well, Mr. Chair, my request is there were many statements made and questions asked and things referenced back to your testimony, so I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to anything that you heard that you may have a differing opinion on, or and I also want to state for the committee's edifice that all the things that have been talked about, I think, are extremely serious and worthy of discussion. However, my goal and my intent with this bill was not to cover every single one of those. It was dealing specifically, you know, with this issue. So with that, is any comments that you would wish to add?
There are. Thank you. I am going back to the example of given where Representative Ramirez or Representative Samuels as a prank. You're exactly correct, Representative Samuels. Yes, there would have to be a complaint, and Representative Dahlstrom referred to it too. But there's another layer in there besides just the court system, and that's the officer also. There is some degree of common sense that is applied to an investigative process. And just because somebody complains that something happened doesn't mean that it's going to be charged as a criminal offense, because there is discretion given to the officer. Obviously, the officers have got to understand the law well enough to know whether it rises to the level of a criminal offense. I think the talk about intent to do harm, I think it's a valuable discussion. I think intent to do harm takes the threshold too high to be able to really stop people before somebody is seriously injured or killed. Possibly language could be entertained, such as exercises or attempts to exercise official authority. That way, their actions show what that intent is. Simply turning on the reds and blues or the siren to pull somebody over is exercising that official authority, or attempting to stop somebody's free movement, which is a constitutional right. And personally, I think it's a very serious violation of somebody's rights to stop their right to free movement. We heard also about phone threats and those not raising to this high of a level. And actually, they do. I believe if you look up the Assault 3, which is a C felony, Assault 3 statute, when somebody makes repeated threats to cause serious harm over the telephone to the person they're speaking to or to a family member, that's a felony offense. As long as it causes fear that really will happen. So that's a felony offense. Representative Coghill referred to juvenile pranks, and I think we've probably all done things in our juvenile years we'd rather have erased, but unfortunately the criminal justice system does erase those when we turn 18. So, and I don't know of any cases where it's been a juvenile impersonating an officer. It's pretty easy for citizens to figure out that this kid's 15 or 16 and not likely a police officer. So the motivation to try and really perpetrate something like that is not very high.
Mr. Chairman, I got to tell you, though, the older I get, the younger they look.
Trooper Cox, we're going to have Jeff Landvetter is back in the room. I'm going to have him come up and join you, just so we have the benefit of your both of your years of service. If you'll introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Trooper Jeff Landvetter. I've been a trooper for just over 22 years. I'm stationed here in Juneau.
Where else have you been stationed, Trooper?
Predominantly here in Juneau.
We thank you for your service to this community and the state and to protecting the citizens. Thank you very much. We've been having a pretty lively conversation regarding whether it crosses over to a C felony to impersonate a peace officer, both in person, at the door, over the phone, on the internet, and or whether there is must be an intent to do harm was the language that we were flirting with. Is that a good summary, Trooper Cox, do you think? I
believe so.
Okay. What kind of thoughts do you have, Trooper Lander?
Well, I apologize for being a little bit late. I was across the street at grand jury, so I got over here as soon as I could. I think this is fundamental to the foundation of a good policing. I mean, we put a high level of trust training into our police. We do extensive background checks. We send them through an intensive academy training and through field training. And for somebody to come on the street and put on a uniform or even carry a phony badge and present themselves as a police officer breaks down that public trust that is so vital for our for us to be able to do our job. We have to have public trust for the public to know that there's somebody safe that's approaching their car that is not going to do them harm. And so I think that this bill is vital to the foundation of good policing. If this started to run rampant where people are impersonating police officers or doing copycat type impersonation because they see somebody in Lower 48 doing it, it makes it very difficult for us to do our job at that point.
Okay. Are there questions for either trooper, or should we bring it back to the committee? Any questions? Yes,
Representative Holmes. Actually, I had a question for Mr. Sobotny, if we could bring it back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gentlemen, can you just make a little way for Mr. Sobotny?
Yeah, bring another chair up.
Okay, Mr. Sobotny.
All set?
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had two questions. The first is Trooper Cox was mentioning a possible sort of intermediate course of rather than just requiring them to do any act in that capacity, adding some sort of requirement, some attempt at exercising official authority. What do you think of that as language in the statute?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that used to be the law before 1978. you had to enlist somebody to aid you in doing something. I think that you have the same problems that Trooper Cox mentioned with proving intent. And so, right now you need to do an act. And as we discussed earlier, that's a pretty broad range of conduct. I think that my off the top of the head idea of talking about intent to do harm, I've kind of been sitting back there doing some refining of that. I think that it does present a proof problem. I agree with the officers. If you ever sit down and you read the oath that they take to be police officers, it's designed to set them as examples of people that you can trust, and that you give up your liberties not your liberty, but you do things for a police officer because they appear to be a police officer that you wouldn't do for somebody else. You stop your car. I mean, if you saw a police officer hitchhiking, you'd probably stop and you may stop and pick them up, where if it was somebody else, you wouldn't do that. And that does create more dangerous situations, both for the police officers in the normal course of their duty and the public when they're responding to somebody that they think they're a police officer and they are not. So as I was sitting back there, my quick drafting was leave the B misdemeanor as it is, make an A misdemeanor, which included with the intent to gain access to a dwelling or the intent to do harm, and the C felony, impersonating a police officer, and commit the B misdemeanor offense. So that would be my suggestion.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that again for the benefit of the committee and the bill sponsor?
Sure. Leave the B misdemeanor as is. That's what this bill does. Make it an A misdemeanor if you impersonate a public servant with the intent to gain access to a dwelling. That's where I really think this is scares people. Or you intend to do harm. And then the C felony offense, as Representative Dahlstrom has it.
Okay. And, I know you have a question, Representative Samuels. What's your response to trifurcating the issue, if that's the right word.
Well, I kind of like the idea, but I don't know that. I'm trying to think about not only the oath they take as being a part of their credibility, but the fact that it also turns out into application. And so I like the idea of going up a degree if it's with the intent to gain access. But once again, the practical matter of it, I just don't know how that shakes out. And I'll leave that to the sponsor. I like it, but I am not going to slow anything down for it.
I share that. Representative Samuelson, Holmes, and then the bill sponsor.
Thank you. I've got a question, I guess, for Mr. Svobodny also. Is my staff has given me the ordinance from Anchorage, and it details what an act is. And a person commits the crime of impersonation of a public officer if the person knowingly and falsely represents himself to be the public officer, and in such assumed character, one, obtains money, property, or another thing of value, two, arrests or detains, threatens to arrest or detain, or otherwise threatens any person, or three, searches a person or property, or four, obtains or requires the assistance of another in any manner pertaining to the duties of a public officer. Do you think we need to, I mean, the problem, of course, with spelling it out is that you're going to miss the one that you want, and a member of the Bar Association is going to throw the case out.
through the chair, representative.
I tend to see the problem with going this direction, but I just wanted to throw it out there. This is what they do in Anchorage. They have it spelled out on what the definitions are of what you called an act.
Representative Samuels for the chair. I think there is danger in spelling it out like that for the exact reasons that you talked about. I mean, you can, I'm sure that if we take a break, I can come up and give you three examples that won't fit.
I just wanted to say this was another option, but I tend to agree with the way we got it. If we wanted to add the third thing to cover the building inspectors, I think I'd be in favor of that, but I'll.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just I think this is clear that we're all preface my comments with saying I think it's clear that we all are very much in support of the intent of the bill, and we're just trying to flesh out levels and burdens and all of that.
Right.
I didn't want anyone to confuse my questions with any disagreement with the intent or the fact that this is a serious problem. Going back to my mental state issue. That sounded interesting, didn't it? Yeah. Quite the way I intended.
You're all going to stay prestige.
going back to my questions about the issue of mental state, putting this in the context of if you could, off the cuff, other felonies, what other types of felonies do we have do we have any that you would sort of equate to this in terms of, you know, obviously, you'd think somebody would knowingly be a police officer, but in the commission of an, how does this stack up against other things that we've made felonies? If that question was all clear.
I think I understand the question through the chair. C felony offense is theft of $500 or more, shoplifting of $500 or more. It is a first time, it is a DWI. It's bootlegging. I'm trying to work my way through here. It is a causing somebody to fear serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, pounding a bat against the wall next to somebody. It's a forgery of a check. I don't think that there's a real clear theme there, but those are examples of C felony offenses.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am really appreciative of the questions, and I know the intent of members on this committee having the honor, and it is an honor to serve on this committee. And I think some very valid points have been presented before us, but my preference, my desire, Mr. Chair, is to move forward with the bill as is, for the reason that once we open this up and start going down this other path, it's opening other areas that if I wish to do that in the future, I can guarantee you it's going to be a much longer bill. It's going to be more of an omnibus crime type bill because of the avenues that it goes off. I want to deal with this with this specific issue right here.
Okay, with that, gentlemen, we thank you for your testimony and assistance. Thank you very much. Public testimony is closed. We'll bring the matter back to the committee. Your bill sponsor, Representative Dahlstrom, you've made your wishes clear. Is there any additional? Representative Cargill?
Mr. Chairman, I think I just heard the sponsor of the bill say, keep your hands off my bill.
That's what I thought I heard.
It never works for me.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the indulgence of asking questions, because anytime we start putting felonies in, I think we need to vet out the good reasons why. And I
agree.
I've been satisfied that the intimidation that can happen from impersonating a police officer is right up there. But I just in my own mind had to be satisfied, because when I read it, the question just said, a felony.
Yep, I agree. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have really appreciated us fleshing this out here. And you know, I still have a few questions in my head, but I'm not going to try to hold the bill up. I'll just continue a one-on-one dialogue with the bill sponsor, and you know, continue to try to get my own head around it.
All right, very good. Well, what are the wishes of the committee?
Can I move my own bill?
Yes, you may.
Mr. Chairman, I would wish to move House Bill Number 286, Version A. With individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 286 moves from committee.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. And once again, thank you for your service to the state and for the invaluable life experience that you bring to a bunch of citizen legislators like us when you come testify before us and give us a sense of what's entailed in doing your duty and cite the hazards that are experienced by members of the community. You continue to make the state of Alaska safer, and we thank you. Okay, with that, we will go to House Bill 281, and our intention is not to move this bill today. Yes, Representative Goddard, please come join us. Uh-huh. Our intent is not to move House Bill 281. Joyce, are you here just for this bill?
Yes.
Okay, so.
I just love the room.
Mr. Subodny, thank you very much for your help today. It's a pleasure to see you as always. Have a nice weekend. We will have the bill before us, then we want to leave ample time for Joyce to be able to testify in person, because it's always more valuable. Representative Johnson, if you are here for House Bill 281, you certainly are welcome to join us up here if you'd like.
I'm a passive observer, sir.
Okay. All right. Who is presenting 281? On behalf of
Representative Lynn, ordinarily, but that's his chief aide.
Welcome. We're so happy to have you here.
My name is Mike Sika, and I work for Representative Lynn. And I was just on the phone with him before I came to the committee meeting.
How
so
are you doing?
He's doing great. He's ready to come back here within a week.
Perfect.
So,
we want to recognize a very colorful press release that you wrote on behalf of your boss. That was one of the best I've read in a long time.
The story wrote itself.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, Mike, go ahead.
So I'll go through this. I'm going to be quick and thorough.
Okay.
HB 281 basically does two things. It increases the statute of limitations to 5 years for filing a complaint with APOC and the Select Committee on Ethics, and it establishes 6 years for the retention of records related to those complaints. You look at this bill and you see several pages, 16 sections, and a lot of words, but it's mostly conforming language that deals with these two issues. And again, we're trying to create a uniform standard for those time length limits and the retention of records under the four sections that are overseen by APOC and the Select Committee. And that's 1513 on election campaigns, 2445 on regulations on lobbying, 2460 standards of conduct for the legislative branch, and 3950 public officials financial disclosure. If you look at the current law, APOC at this time has a one-year statute of limitations. It was changed from 4 years in 2003, and some problems have arose as a result of that, where you can't go back and investigate alleged violations. The Select Committee has a two-year statute of limitations, and it has an interesting clause at the end of that section. There is no limit if there's an intentional prevention of discovery. So we're looking to extend all that to the same amount of time, 5 years. And the reason why there's 6 years for the retention of records, we just figured it made sense that if you're going to go back 5 years to accept a complaint, you're going to want to have the records for it.
Mike, a quick question. I have the K version.
Yeah, it's the K version.
Is that correct? And I don't think that needs to be adopted. I think we have the K version in front of us. Is that correct? Thank you, Susan. Okay, and I also want to recognize that Representative Gatto, you're a prime sponsor of this bill as well.
Co-sponsor,
right?
Correct.
Right.
Okay.
Sorry.
And I want to remind the members that we still have the same speedy adjudication process. Once with APOC an investigation begins, it cannot go no more than 60 days under the code. Other states, real quickly, their statute of limitations, I've seen them range from 1 to 5. Some have no limits. Georgia is an interesting case. It has 3 years for two-year terms and 5 years for four-year terms. And some have an intentional prevention of discovery clause, and some have a combination. That's basically the bill. Representative Lynn wanted me just to raise another issue. In state affairs, we went and I believe it was Representative Dahl proposed an amendment, and it passed. And it changed the current, it will change the current law on who can file a complaint. Currently, under almost all these sections, any person can complain. The exception is lobbying. Currently, it's a qualified person. And so that means that under person as defined in state law, that covers everyone from a natural person to the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, ACPR, the League of Women Voters. And Brooke Miles can talk on this, but briefly, she's told me that most of the complaints that come into APOC come in during election time from political parties. They do a wonderful job of keeping each other in line. And by allowing them to file Representative Lynn feels that rather than an individual candidate, it actually depersonalizes and depoliticizes what could be a nasty feud. So that's how it's worked in the past. So we'd like you to revisit the issue. And he feels the issue of trust is based on the merits of the complaint rather than the qualifications of the person who complains. And he also asked me to pass on to you that you know, we're seeing this is not a new ethics bill. It's just an attempt to make fixes. Like there's a good bill that passed on compassionate gift giving, and in this case, it's maybe a loophole that needs to be tightened. And his main concern is that by taking us, he wants to see us take a step forward by increasing the statute of limitations, and possibly not take one backwards by greatly limiting the number of legitimate complaints for the system.
Thank you. Representative Gatto is a co-prime sponsor. Do you have anything you want to add to the introduction to this bill?
Just some background. I mean, as a legislator, I've had two complaints filed against me, and I'm not sure, in the course of elections time. One was both were dismissed after the election was over, and it's fairly easy to file a complaint on a person, and the newspapers got the second complaint before I got it. And they asked me my opinion about the complaint, and I had to have them read the complaint to me. And of course that went on, and that's useful for any person in electioneering. So I take a strong interest in who can file a complaint and when a complaint, how a complaint is heard, and the how we recover from complaints being filed. So that's my my input on this bill.
Okay, are there members questions for Mike Sieg?
Yes.
For the Representative Gatto?
I'll just start at the beginning, I guess, on all businesses that furnish any of the supplies to a candidate shall maintain a record of each transaction for a period of 6 years from the election. So PIP Printing, or let's say it's a new printing company, you know the Smith Printing Company, I hire them. It's just a printing job to them. It has absolutely nothing to do with the political arena whatsoever. They don't care what it says. They're just getting paid to print it. For 6 years, they have to maintain a record of each transaction. I believe IRS records are only three. Mm-hmm. They're not going to know that just for this one job. When I first ran for office, I don't remember the guy's name. I got given a guy's name. It was not a major printing house. It was just this little one-man shop. He was a friend of a friend of a friend. I went there, and my very first thing that I ever printed, the little palm card that you used to go door to door with, I went and hired this guy. And then you start getting help, as we all do, from other people, and they say, you know, here's how it works. You go to the big things, you get discounts, and you kind of get in the scheme of things. But this one man, there's no way he's going to know he has to keep this one record for 6 years. But that's what it says. I understand. Actually, my second question is, now I have to keep it for 6 years after I leave office. I'm not going to be thinking about you all. you know, and to find a canceled check to PIP Printing from 6 years before, from an account which was closed 6 years ago, I'm just making sure I will have, you could have moved.
Congress isn't that far away, Representative Sanders. Joyce, would you can you come up and join us, please? I'm just mindful of the clock that it's 2:30. Point is well taken. And Joyce, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Do you have some preliminary remarks that you want to make, and then just make yourself available? And then for the benefit of the members, Brooke Miles is with us by telephone. Brooke, can you hear us?
I can, Mr. Chair.
All right, and Brooke, if you'll stand by, if you have anything that's germane or members have questions for Brooke, but because we have Joyce here, we know the benefit of having somebody here in the committee room. If we get an introduction by Joyce, then if you'll direct your questions to her. And Ms. Joyce, your intent, if we can wrap this up now, is not to return on Monday as vis-a-vis 281, is that correct?
I would hope that it would be wrapped up today, but if not, I understand that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm sorry. Do you have any?
Those two. That's the first section. So it's as far as I've gotten on the specifics, but is, I guess, for other states is 6 years for me individually. I think is. I mean, I will stick everything in a box, I guess, and hope I don't lose it when I move from house to house or this or that, but 6 years to the company that provides, you know, the printing service.
Through the chair, this is Mike Zika again. I think Brooke Miles would be best to answer this because it falls into the APOC section. However, yes. I'd like to point out that the law is currently silent on the number of years retained. So I'd be interested to know how they do it as well. I think Brooke could respond to that.
Okay, Brooke, if you can do that. Then we want to give Joyce an opportunity to make her remarks.
Sure. Mr. Chair, did you want me to respond to that first, or you want to hear from Joyce first?
I think because of the questions on the table, you can just go ahead and respond.
Okay. Well, you know, of course, the section that, Mr. Chair, the second section that Representative Samuels is talking about is the provider of services, and where that may likely include the Kinko account, that's unlikely. But the bigger people are campaign managers, the media providers and producers, the poll providers and producers. These are the people that we're getting at to keep the records.
See that.
And that's why they've been included in the statute. They just have a one-year statute of limitations. And frankly, the commission has heard a lot from the public about what they think of a one-year statute of limitations.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now I'm jumping right on board with my colleague to my left here. Campaign manager, first of all, I'm not sure that, it says pretty clearly in here, radio, TV, advertising, opinion polls, things like that. Professional campaign consultation, you know, I hired a campaign manager in my last campaign. She worked for me for 8 weeks, 6 weeks, hired her after the primary. She'd never done this before. She made it very clear to me in no uncertain terms that coming down to work for me in Juneau was, you know, like the fourth or fifth option down on her list. She had other things she wanted to go on and do, and is off happily working in a whole other branch, non-political. So for 6 or 8 weeks, she helped me out with my campaign, and now for the next 6 years, even though she has left Anchorage, moved somewhere else, she's required to keep all these records for 6 years as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, to Representative, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you, Holm. We would expect in that situation that the campaign keeps the record. She was working for the campaign. She wasn't Northwest Strategies. She wasn't Helen Tholen Associates. She was an individual that had a contractual agreement to work for the candidate, and we would anticipate that the candidate would retain her billing and, you know, the accounts receivable and payable.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I understand what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying, but that's not what it says in the page in front of me. The entire sentence reads, all businesses, persons, or groups that furnish any of the following services, facilities, or supplies to a candidate or group shall maintain a record of each transaction for a period of 6 years from the date of the election, and it lists newspapers, radio, television, advertising, ad agencies, accounting, billboards, printing, secretarial, opinion polls. I understand that the situation that has arisen, and obviously we all follow that situation. So, but the concept that you're talking about is not what's printed on page 1 and 2.
Well, and I really can't debate that those words. That's part of what. That's just the existing statute. The only thing that's been changed there is the 1 to the 6. So, I'm sure that it could be crafted much more carefully. I am only testifying as to how the commission staff has used that as an enforcement tool.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much, Brooke. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at Section 2, which deals with preservation of records and required to report. So unless you are reporting to APOC, you are not required to preserve the records. And so I would go back to Ms. Miles' statement that the campaign is required to maintain the records, since the campaign is the one that makes the reports. The individual that you purchase from isn't making any report to APOC. They make a report to maybe their shareholders or the mom and dad that own the business. So does Section 2 pretty much alleviate the difficulty reported by Representative Holmes and Representative Samuels for Section 1?
Section 2 does, as you said, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Gatto, it does address the filer's retaining of records. It's the candidate, the political party, the PACs, the groups that support and oppose ballot questions, including individuals who must make reports because they participate in independent expenditures or things of that nature. The Section 1 applies to providers of services. And as I said before, I really can't debate the beauty of that language. It may serve better if it was rewritten, but it is the Section 1 that requires providers of campaign services to retain records currently for 1 year, and Section 2 that would be new and now asks filers to also keep records.
Okay, very good. Joyce, I want to make sure that we focus on your testimony and what kind of ruffled feathers you uncover here in this bill. So if you'll give us your testimony and then make yourself available for questions.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Joyce Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Not sure I ruffled any feathers, but I will definitely go through my testimony. The section of the bill that deals with the Legislative Ethics Code is Section 8. And that particular section of the bill has changed the time in which a complaint could be filed from 2 years to 5 years. We've also taken out some language in there that was recommended by Representative Coghill in the House State Affairs Committee. We took out about when a member is a subject of the complaint as a former member of the legislature, and again the legislator down on line 11 on page 4, and that's because we have now increased the statute to 5 years versus 2. I'm also here to answer any questions about the subject that Mr. Sika brought up from the House State Affairs Committee about having the a complaint filed by a registered voter versus any person. And in the Legislative Ethics Act, the statute has always said any person. And so any person can file a complaint against a legislator or any other individual who's covered by the Legislative Ethics Act. We have not had any issues in the past with that. We have had, to my knowledge, just individuals versus groups filing complaints. We have had an individual who represented a political party and under their name file a complaint, and that happened several years ago. But at this point, we haven't had anyone from out of state or, you know, anything like that file complaints. Furthermore, under the ethics code, the complaint is actually reviewed prior to any action taken by the ethics committee in executive session. So in regard to what Representative Gatto was saying earlier, APOC handles their complaints a little bit differently than we do under the ethics committee. The committee takes a review of that. They look at the complaint. They determine whether it's under the ethics committee jurisdiction and whether the allegation, if proven true, would be a violation and then would move forward. If they look at the complaint and it doesn't follow those two requirements, the complaint is dismissed and not followed at all, and it's never made public. So we look at it a little bit differently than APOC, where all those complaints are public, whether they're moved into the investigative stage or not. So I guess I just wanted to point that out because I know that they have changed in the statute to use registered voter versus either any person or qualified voter. So I'm here to answer any of those questions. Also, if you have any questions regarding what Mr. Sika had said about adding some language in where there is an intentional prevention of discovery, which was a recommendation to put into the area under the Alaska Public Offices Commission to make it consistent with what's in the Legislative Ethics Act.
Thank you. And a question, I guess, for both Mr. Sika and yourself is by changing person, therefore you're eliminating, so the Republican Party could not file a complaint against Democrat candidate X, and the Democratic Party could not file a complaint. You'd have to find a talking head for you. You have to find a registered voter.
That's how I read it. Yes.
And you had talked about that, and I thought in your remarks that you talked about going actually the opposite way. You thought it was less personal to have the party be able to go without getting somebody's name attached to it, and you said, look, Party X thinks that candidate Y did something wrong.
That's how the current law reads. That's how Representative Lynn had put the bill in. It was changed in state affairs. And
And I could add a little bit
okey
of
dokey. That. Okay. I thought that's what you'd said. So.
Yeah. And I'd be glad to talk about it just a little bit. Part of the discussion was limiting these types of complaints within the voter base of Alaska. I don't know that it was necessarily contemplated a lot on how political groups might hold each other accountable. I think it was the question of who this person could be anywhere in the world, anywhere in the United States, anywhere in any business, and inviting complaints from every sector. So I know how the sponsors feel about it, but in our committee process in the state affairs, there was a concern that it should be an Alaska issue, and so I think that's why it was narrowed down to a voter. So, and there was some debate on the difference between a qualified voter, registered voter, and that actually some of that language is in here in other venues. So. Then it became the question of if we do it one place, should we do it every place? I think that's part of the reason why it was asked to come to the Judiciary Committee. And we did have also a legal opinion that I think we need to contemplate before we get it out of here. But there was some debate, and it was agreed that by a person, but I don't know that there was a unanimous consent on that. It was just a discussion.
Okay.
I mean, the one representative sitting in the room, in the back of the room, felt very strongly about it, and we did have that discussion though. So.
Representative Gatto?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A registered voter, and I'm going to ask you also, is that a voter in Cincinnati and a voter in Chicago, or only an Alaskan registered voter? Because what it says, is that something we need to address?
Through the chair.
Yes.
Anticipating that registered voter was going to come up, we prepared an amendment to define it as it's defined right now under 1507. And it's basically what it takes to be a registered voter in the state.
And I would say, Mr. Chairman, it was assumed that, but it needs to be expressed. But I think that is one of the questions we're going to have to ask in a committee is, do we want to stay with that language? Because there is a legitimate argument that you might have groups holding each other accountable, but then you also have that debate on groups that just want to work the process so hard that somebody can never get out of a cloud, you know? And so the question is, who should be able to do it? And the anticipation was why they would do it. And I don't know that we actually got there totally, but that was the discussion.
Joyce, do you have other 30,000-foot view remarks for us? Every time we get into elected guys, you know, man, if we want to talk a lot about unmarked police cars, we can go for an hour, but we can go 10 hours on what we all can and can't do. I'm always mindful of time. What are some of your other thoughts, please?
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I guess I agree with the comments from Mr. Sika. And take, for instance, the League of Women Voters or ACPIRG. You know, they're very well-known groups that sort of are watchdog groups, if you want to use that term. And if they wanted to file a complaint, either against, you know, a campaign complaint or with the financial disclosure or with the ethics office, I think that filing the complaint under the name of the League of Women Voters, or ACPIRG, would be different than having the president of that organization file the complaint. And in some way, that the president or Mr. Cleary from ACPIRG would file the complaint, and that would be on the complaint down the road and so forth. Whereas if it's filed by the League of Women Voters, they know that it was not an individual that filed the complaint. It was a group that filed the complaint because they felt that there was an issue versus just one person. And so I guess I look at that as a little bit differently than having an individual, which would be let's say the League of Women Voters, the president didn't want to file the complaint. Would they have to get another member to file the complaint? So I guess I'm looking at, I think that we need to leave open the option for organizations to file complaints versus just registered voters.
Just in that regard, because APOC operates so differently than the ethics on the complaint structure, mm-hmm. The question was, the complaint is not confidential. It goes out in public. It has its own issue. And so then if it's not an individual who's willing to put their name on the line, then one individual is hurt and one group gets a benefit. And so I think that was kind of the feeling that it should be, if it's going to be a personal issue, it should be by a person. And so I think there was some of that discussion. And I would just say that there's probably legitimate debate on both sides, but then there's the problem of legitimate accountability, and then those who just want to go hunt for people.
Okay, before we get bogged down, because I'm very interested in the public process, and I'm interested in Alaskan voters feeling like it's a clean game, especially what we've been through in the last couple of years. But what I'm missing so far, and I read the sponsor statement for the bill. Joyce, can you detail for me, please, what is this bill about? What is the theme of this bill? What are we achieving for the public good? Because otherwise, we will get so bogged down in precisely the issues that Representative Samuels raised, and precisely who is a person, because we've all had the complaints. So this is a in my backyard bill, and it's. And it could swallow this committee for a week. So I think that's what I'm interested in. And I'll probably ask the same question of Brooke Miles, just so that we can kind of put a ring fence around what is the subject matter and exactly what we're trying to progress and make safer for the public. Joyce?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the main intent of the bill is to increase the time frame in which a complaint can be filed against an individual. With the ethics statute, it's 2 years. And Brooke can address the statutes that she covers. And so is 2 years really long enough to have a complaint filed against an individual based on the fact that they may be in office 2 years or 4 years, or based on the fact that maybe the facts don't come forward until after the two-year time frame? And so the intent of the bill is to open up the time frame for filing complaints and allow the public, if they obtain knowledge regarding an issue that may have happened 2 years and 3 months ago, that they're still allowed to file a complaint on that particular action.
And what is the nature of this complaint? I mean, I remember hearing about Don Young and his hot dog cart, and he didn't care because a certain amount of those years, statute of limitations was over. What can you use an example of what I may have done that was unethical that a registered voter or an organization might want to cite me for more than 2 years after the event transpired?
Well, I guess the most obvious would be some of the issues that we've dealt with right now with the indictments.
Specifically what? Because a lot of those were things that happened while the person was serving in office and not necessarily something that surrounded campaign records, polls, literature, things that would be held by a Dittman or a...
And Brooke could be best to answer that. I would be talking more about trying to influence State Departments to get a bill passed or some of the issues that have come up during the previous indictments.
Okay, so in
that are definitely related to duties as a legislator versus campaigning or polls or anything. So I can address that particular part of the in relation to the Legislative Ethics Act.
Okay, perfect. So I grasp that. So it pertains to lengthening the statute of limitations while we are serving, but not necessarily relative to Section 2 as much, which goes to campaign records and the manner in which we went about getting elected. You see this bill focusing more on conduct while we're in office and lengthening the window of the statute of limitations to be able to follow us for a longer period of time because of some of the things that we saw happen in the last 12 to 18 months.
Is that in correct? Relation to the Legislative Ethics Act, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. Are there any other main themes that you see with House Bill 281, or do we quickly just get immersed into the minutia of the bill?
I think you should move forward.
Okay, thank you. Brooke, can you please give us the same overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Brooke Miles. I'm the Executive Director for the Public Offices Commission. And it was the commission who went on record requesting that legislation be considered that would increase the statute of limitations. Having a one-year statute of limitations from the time of the alleged violation for which the commission can or a member of the public begin an investigation was shown to be way too short. We have been literally raked over the coals and blamed for it, and I've been personally attacked for paying attention to a statute of limitations. And so the commission went on record as saying that that needed to be expanded and strongly supports expanding that. In working through the statutes that the Alaska Public Offices Commission administers, those being financial disclosure for public officials and a small part of the ethics law, which contains the financial disclosures that are filed by legislators, the regulation of lobbying, and the campaign disclosure, we had a mismatch of statutes of limitations or none at all, which then you have to go to another section of law to determine what the appropriate statute of limitations is. With respect to things that might have gone wrong and the commission could not pursue, issues like major corporations giving all of their executives giving campaign contributions that were paid for directly by the corporation, clear violations of the law, over which it came to light, are pled out in federal court. One presumes it's the truth, and APSC can't do anything about it. The records retention only makes sense to the commission to have a records retention that at least matches or supersedes by 1 year the statute of limitations. The reason being that when you're going back to look at an allegation of a violation that may have occurred 4 years ago, if no one has any documentation to help you, it's going to be more difficult. So that's why the records retention, that's why a request for an expansion of the statute of limitations. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I would also like to speak in favor of getting rid of the registered voter idea. Under our laws, one law had a requirement that a person filing a complaint, that was the lobbying law, by the way, be a qualified voter. Otherwise, any person could file a complaint, including the commission staff. It could bring a staff-initiated complaint.
Okay.
The argument that was brought in state affairs was, you know, that people didn't want foreign nationals stomping in here and starting to file complaints against candidates. And I have to tell you, in the 30-some years that the campaign disclosure law has been around, oh, my gosh, that's never happened. However, there have been complaints that were brought forward by groups that aren't registered voters, groups and also by political parties. And sometimes in the heat of the campaign, having that brought by a non-person helps depoliticize the whole complaint. It is true that with respect to the commission's complaint, the complaint itself is a public document. Unfortunately, people file them with APOC, and oftentimes their next stop is the press. However, this staff makes every effort it can to get a copy to the respondent right away. Then, instead of my commission having to meet and determine whether if it meets all the procedures set out in statute and regulation, which include, does it allege a violation, which, if true, could be a violation of a law within the jurisdiction of the commission, the staff rejects it.
Okay, Brooke, thank you very much. Rep. Samuel has a question. We're going to go over by 10 minutes, 15 minutes today.
Mr. Chairman, I do have the domestic violence board that I'm going to have to go. I mean, both of us are going to have to go. It starts at 3.
All right. Rep. Samuels, quickly.
I wanted to make a point, and I see the advantages of going and leaving it as a person instead of a registered voter. The downside of doing that is you get individuals who get to hide behind the skirts of a name and all political sides, they get to hide behind somebody else's, you know, you think of the name of a group and
point made.
So.
Point made. Representative Gatto, as a prime sponsor, are we well into the content and the purpose of 281 to your way of thinking with the testimony offered by Mike Sika, Joyce, and Brooke?
If I can make a comment that is in agreement with Representative Samuels, how do we know that the League of Women Voters 100% of them have agreed to any one statement.
I'm talking about the broader context.
Right. And the broader one, registered Alaska voter, to me, should be substituted for voter. I forgot how it's in there. Because we do have it on one of the pages in here, a registered Alaska voter, and I think that's who it should be limited to.
Okay, and then finally, Representative Johnson, you were on state affairs. Can you very quickly summarize the concerns that brought you into our committee room?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I have a couple we haven't addressed yet that we could do at a future meeting. But the registered voter thing was definitely something I brought up.
Okay. We're aware of that.
And I think it's important that if we're going to be held accountable, I don't want complaints to be used as political tools.
Okay.
And I think if someone has the fortitude and the knowledge and right on their side to put their name on it,
okay.
But a person, by definition, under Alaskan statute, is anything.
Okay. Any other broad brush points?
That's it.
Okay. So I think we clearly understand the nature of the subject and the public good that we are supposed to be accomplishing, and we will take this up next week under bills previously heard. Any final remarks, Joyce? All right. We thank you, Brooke. We thank you also. Have a nice weekend. Mike Sika, thank you very much for presenting on behalf of Representative Lynn. It's 3 minutes after 3, and we are adjourned.